Welcome back, friends. We left off with the patristic father from the West. And so now we're going to look at the father, patristic father from the East, St. John Damascene, one of the earliest theologians of the church, in the church. He records an interesting story concerning the Assumption. So this would be his understanding. St. Juvenal, J-U-V-E-N-A-L, Bishop of Jerusalem. And so we'll come back to this bit, the Jerusalem aspect here. At the Council of Chalcedon in 451, made known to the Emperor Marcion and Pulcheria, who wished to possess the body of the Mother of God, that Mary died in the presence of all the apostles, but that her tomb, when opened upon the request of St. Thomas, was found empty, wherefrom the apostles concluded that the body was taken up to heaven. So the Bishop of Jerusalem, back in 451, wants to, have a Marian procession and do something in honor of Our Lady. So they go to the tomb and they open it and see that the body is not there. And there's that capital T with tradition that that when they did go to open the tomb for Thomas, who wasn't there at her passing with the others, they realized the tomb is empty. And as Sarah says, there's a lot of artwork that shows an empty tomb with a lot of flowers. And we do know where the bodies of Peter and Paul are buried. And we know where James was beheaded. A goodly number of the apostles, we do know where their remains are. I don't recall all of them, but I remember seeing a poster. But Our Lady, I mean, we have where the true cross was St. Helen. Mm-hmm. But Our Lady's body, that's not the sort of thing you were not going to lose that.
No, you would not lose Our Lady's body. You would know where your mother is buried.
You would know where your mother is buried, is right. So the patristics would summarize we're free to, take whichever story we like that makes most sense. Those are apocryphal. But it's right. The theological grounding that's in play that Pius XII is going to, and that's what the patristic fathers really rely on in defending the Assumption. It's on two counts. It's what Sarah said at the very beginning of this series. Since Mary was sinless and a perpetual virgin, she could not suffer bodily deterioration, the result of original sin after her death. There was no stain in her. And the second point is that if Mary bore Christ and played an intimate role as his mother in the redemption of man, then she must likewise share body and soul in his resurrection glorification. So those were the two points. Since, like she said, December 8th, right, the two bookends, her immaculate, she was preserved without sin. She was assumed into body and soul because she was sinless, not just at the moment of her consent, but all through her life, right. She says yes. And that her role, my soul, right, what Sarah said, my soul magnifies the Lord. She conceived with him, and she immediately goes to service to Zechariah or the wine at Cana, or she's at Pentecost, or, the major points of the formation of the church.
Absolutely. She's present. Yeah. I would like to, if I may, I don't know if I'm changing the subject a little bit, but just in regards to this, the importance of this, this dogma of the church, we are so blessed in the United States to have essentially the Shrine of Our Lady of Good Help in Wisconsin, which is, by Mary's own words, at this apparition. And we have to separate here once again that a dogma must be believed. It's defined by the church, and a Catholic in good standing must accept and assent in faith to the teaching that Mary was bodily assumed. Now, a Marian apparition is not of the same genre. What it is given is piety of belief. You have that there is nothing, it's worthy of belief, that you, there is nothing that is going to be taught at this particular apparition that could cause harm or would in any way, shape, or form vary from what has been taught by the church. But in Wisconsin, in a little town called Champion, the Blessed Mother appeared and introduced herself to a woman from Belgium named Sister Adele Breeze as Queen of Heaven. And this apparition site, which is unknown, which tragically unknown in the United States, this apparition occurred only 2 years after the Blessed Mother appeared to Saint Bernadette at Lourdes, where she proclaimed herself as the other embodiment of the other Marian dogma, which is, and these are the only two times in the history of the church that the Pope has spoken ex cathedra, are specifically in the definition of two Marian dogmas. One, that she was conceived immaculately, and secondarily, that she was assumed body and soul into heaven. But this apparition in Wisconsin, as I said, was only 2 years after Lourdes, which is right around 1873. And so it's just a very beautiful opportunity for anyone who lives in the United States, who has always longed to go to Lourdes to be near our Blessed Mother, to know that actually she came here. She is with us here, and in a very fitting way, because that area of Wisconsin is essentially the jumping off point of the Catholic Church being dispersed into the inner part of the country. That's where the first Mass was heard, and that's where the first explorers and the great Jesuits who came, Father Marquette and Joliet, came and brought the teachings to the interior of the country. So, but I mean, please look that up. Maybe Karen can post somehow a link to the address at that beautiful shrine, because it is very unknown, and it's a very intimate place to go and be with Our Lady.
I'll put it up in, I have, as Sarah and I get better at doing this and we have more skills, I'm now putting up a synopsis of our shows, because I've got to sit and watch our shows anyway to take out things we like and things we might need to fix, or, right, you know, we might recall a thought off the top of the head, or we misspoke and that sort of thing. And I absolutely can put in both a link in the description and also in the video itself about this beautiful Marian shrine in Wisconsin. Absolutely. So I want to always show my sources. This is where I was taking patristics. Marian, the Fathers of the Church, the Blessed Virgin Mary and Patristic Thought by Luigi Gambaro Ignatius. It's a new public, it's relatively new, I think, 2000s? My source here. 1999, so it's recent, but it's written in our way of speaking and our way of thought, so it's an easier read. So there was, I know you like Father Saunders, he had an insight on dormition. So Sarah used the word speculation, and so what speculation means is opinion. Well, we all hope we have well-reasoned opinions, mm-hmm. And some people have opinion Our Lady went to sleep because she already experienced death under the foot of the cross on Good Friday, and certainly Holy Saturday was another time of sorrow for Our Lady. But then there's some who think that, you know, in conforming her life to our Lord's, she too would have had an actual death. So the church, not wanting to weigh into those two theological camps, uses the term dormition. In the Holy Father, and then Saint Gregory of Tours, mm-hmm. talk about when the end of her earth, the course of her earthly life had come to an end.
Right.
The Byzantine Emperor Mauritius, 582, so 500s, you know, 500, late 500s, established the Feast of the Dormition of the Blessed Virgin Mary on August 15th for the Eastern Church, which was celebrated Our Lady's death and resurrection. And some historians speculate, this is from Father Saunders, some historians speculate that the celebration was already widespread before the Council of 431. That's right. The church fathers, it's not like they go into a council and, oh, do we have any new thoughts we're taking up? No. Oh, that's a brand new thought. No. They will be bringing up things. That's right. It has been long percolation. And that's how you get onto the agenda.
Right. Well, you come to meet to have a discussion about something that you're already having life with. I mean, and also we always have to remember that historically speaking, the church was being persecuted until, what, 304? I mean, you have hundreds of years of public persecution. And just because there was one proclamation by one emperor that now it was legal, it's jejune and naive to presume that suddenly everything was peaceful and delightful for Christians. I mean, it still was going to take a long time for institutional hatreds to pass away and for the fruition of the Christian to be able to come out and become lived in public life. And then you have to kind of creating traditions from whole cloth, small tree traditions. How are we going to live this faith that we have been living in the catacombs silently? How are we going to live this publicly now, right? So the fact that it takes from, you know, 310, let's say 314 to 500 before there's a public statement of we're going to have this feast celebrated on this day does not, I mean, it obviously was taken into account of what had been going on before.
That's correct. That's exactly right. And then, so we've waded into the speculation of, did Our Lady go to sleep or did she die? There's been two claims for where Our Lady entered into her dormition. The first and the oldest, but I always thought it was Ephesus, but apparently that's second and more recent. The older claim is Jerusalem. And that goes back to, Gregory of Tours. Mm. Yes. Mm. No. This is going to St. John Damascene. Excuse me. Okay. St. John Damascene, 741. When the emperor wanted to have this procession or outpouring of love and open the tomb, and it wasn't there. That's the Bishop of Jerusalem.
Right.
He's opening the tomb in Jerusalem.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I had always thought it was Ephesus also.
I had always thought it was Ephesus, but this was, and in the Holy Land, there's the Church of the Dormition, and it's close to, it's in the Kidron Valley, and the tomb's close to the tomb of our Lord. It's called the Tomb of Mary, at the foot of the Mount of Olives.
Very interesting. I'd never heard that. So
I had not either until I did.
It's a beautiful image to think of Our Lady's tomb and Our Lord's tomb, you know, within proximity of one another. I mean, I can't imagine that, you know. I mean, I don't think there is. Is there any real statement as to where she was? I mean, she was taken into care by John. Obviously. And isn't it so that the house of Ephesus, it wasn't supposed to have been brought there miraculously?
I should have some little. This is from, I'm trying to see where was this source? Early sources are summarized in this way. Oh, it's from the Catholic Encyclopedia.
Okay.
The apocryphal works of the second to the fourth century are all favorable to the Jerusalem tradition. This is according to the Catholic Encyclopedia. According to the Acts of St. John by Procurius, written 160 to 170, By Lysias the evangelist went to Ephesus, which is accompanied by Prochorus alone, and at a very advanced age, that is, after Mary's death. So, right. According to that source, the evangelist went to Ephesus. Okay, right, to Ephesus. Then there are two letters written about 370 show that the Blessed Virgin passed the remainder of her days at Jerusalem. So she was at Ephesus, but then she goes back to Jerusalem. That of Dionysius the Areopagite to the Bishop Titus in 363 placed her tomb at Gethsemane. The evangelist went to Ephesus alone and at a very advanced stage, that is, after Mary's death. So it sounds like Mary was in Jerusalem the whole time.
Right, that's what it sounds like, yeah. I had no idea.
There was never any tradition, lower T, connecting Mary's death.
It would seem very appropriate that Mary would ascend from, that her assumption would be from Jerusalem. I mean, in terms of just scriptural and biblical imagery, because the New Jerusalem, which is, Mary is always an image of the Holy City, right? In some, she's adorned with jewels. And so the fact that she would be taken up from there and, you know, all graces are dispensed through her hand to us. So it's kind of very beautiful.
It is beautiful. All right. We'll stop there.